I found out that I was going to be giving this talk about a month ago, 5 weeks ago, and I could not think of what to talk about. Nothing really popped up in terms of Zen and Buddhism and the sort of things I usually, you know, try to focus in on. Nothing came to mind. And then I read an article in the New York Times. It was published July 8th. And it was another article about Buddhist nationalism in some majority Buddhist countries. And in this article, the article focused on Myanmar and Sri Lanka, and one of the things that was written was, quote, that these countries are, quote, on the forefront of a radical religious nationalist movement. And so we've all heard about this, and I decided I should try to make some comments about it. A couple of things before I start doing that. One is, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And what I know about this, I've learned only from the newspaper and mostly from what I've read in the last several weeks, using the time that I had. So my knowledge of these things is pretty superficial. Also, I want to just say ahead of time that I'm going to cite a few numbers here in terms of, you know, so the percentage of populations of some countries in terms of the religious affiliation or identities. And these are generalizations, of course. You know, people are complex, they're not just one thing, and things aren't just black and white. So now we've all heard about the Rohingya. This is an ethnic minority, largely living in the Rakhine state of Myanmar. And we've heard about the violence perpetrated against them by the majority Buddhist population. And that includes, you know, destruction of villages, basically wiping them off the face of the earth, rape and murder, and other kinds of terrible things. And we've heard that, and I will just say what I have read, which there are highly influential Buddhist clergy in Myanmar that fan the flames of violence, glorifying the military and referring to the Rohingya as some subhuman invaders. So here are just a few numbers, and I'm not going to cite all of them. Since August of 2017, so in the last 2 years, since August 25th, 2017, estimates are that about 24,000 Rohingya have been killed by the military and local Buddhists. And also since that date, in the past 2 years, more than 723,000 Rohingya have fled into Bangladesh. And there are estimated to be about 1.1 million Rohingya now living in Bangladesh. 723,000 is about the same size as the population of Seattle, which I just looked up yesterday. It's a lot of people. There are other numbers, numbers related to rape of women and girls and people thrown into fire. But I'm not going to say those tonight. They're available on the web, in Wikipedia. So that's Myanmar. A little information about Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is another majority Buddhist country. And I think the estimates are around, that number escapes me. It's high, somewhere around 90%, 70 to 90%. In Sri Lanka, there's a very old but prominent belief among the Sinhalese majority Buddhists that the Sinhalese are Buddhism's chosen people, that Sri Lanka is their rightful homeland, and that violence carried out in its creation against non-Buddhists was justifiable because it preserved Buddhism. Sort of ironic. This belief was chronicled in a text from the 6th century called the Mahavamsa, which includes an account of the Buddhist warrior king Duttagamani defeating the Tamil king Ilara with an army of 500 Buddhist monks. And as the story goes, when King Duttakamani was lamenting the thousands that were killed by his forces, he was consoled, it said, by the eight arhats, which are Buddhist enlightened disciples, who told him that the defeated Tamil were no better than beasts, and that his actions brought glory to the doctrine of Buddha. And probably many of us know that tension between the Sinhalese majority and the minority Tamil, most of whom are Hindu, persists to this day. And Sri Lanka suffered a civil war between 1983 and 2009 when the Tamil Tigers attempted to create an independent Tamil state in Sri Lanka. More recently, Buddhists have attacked others, attacked those in other of other religions in Sri Lanka as well, including Christians and Muslims. In this July New York Times article that I mentioned, it was published July 8th, a Buddhist abbot is quoted as characterizing Muslims as violent and rapacious, something we've heard before from other people about other groups. Then a little about Thailand. Thailand's population is 92% Buddhist, but the southernmost provinces are 85% Muslim, where a Muslim separatist movement exists, and where an insurgency campaign has led to the deaths in the last couple of years, as of 2017, of 7,000 people. I read an abstract from a book published in 2011, and the title of the book is Buddhist Fury, which details the religious conflict in this region. Here's an excerpt from the summary of the book. Quote, "The book follows the southern Thai Buddhist monks and their practices in Thailand's deep south. Many Buddhist practices remain unchanged. Buddhist monks continue to chant, counsel the laity, and accrue merit. Yet at the same time, some monks zealously advocate Buddhist nationalism, act as covert military officers, and equip themselves with guns." It turns out that the Buddhist nationalists in these three countries, Myanmar, Sri Lanka, and Thailand, encourage each other using social media. So here's another quote, and this is from a Whitman College professor from a 2017 U.S. News article. Quote, "The ways in which these Buddhist nationalist individuals and communities interact with each other via Facebook, via Twitter, it amplifies the false narratives about particular events and supports what might have been thoughts in the backs of people's minds. It encourages those thoughts to grow into strong beliefs that may ultimately lead to violence." There was another recent article about social media in Myanmar, and the internet is a relatively new phenomenon in Myanmar, and Facebook has a lot of penetration there. In fact, what I read was that in Myanmar, for a lot of people, Facebook is the internet. So what they see on Facebook is what they believe is the internet is about. Well, a lot could be said, a lot more could be said, facts and figures, but you get the idea. So what to do then? As someone who calls himself a Buddhist, I'm drawn to think about what I can and should do about harm that's being done in the name of protecting and preserving Buddhism. And when I submitted the title for this talk, the top title of the talk is What's a Buddhist? I had it in mind to somehow speak about this question in the context of reported violence among Buddhists. I thought I might come up with some perspective that, you know, bears some shade of wisdom. And I can tell you right now that I haven't come up with anything new. Many of you are probably already thinking that from a Zen perspective, a question like this, what's a Buddhist, has no definitive answer. That Buddhist is a word, a concept, that floats in a sea of relativity with no absolute meaning. So, you know, in our tradition, we have a principal teaching is don't know, and holding on to concepts like Buddhist is about as helpful as encasing our one's feet in concrete. As soon as I say Buddhist, then I've created a false dichotomy. Buddhist on the one hand, non-Buddhist on the other. So the way I think of it now is that I am a so-called Buddhist, a provisional Buddhist, a Buddhist for the sake of discussion. What then does a so-called Buddhist have to say about violence perpetrated by other so-called Buddhists? other than it's bad and springs from ignorance. It's been difficult for me, like I said, to find something insightful to say, something of value. Everybody knows that rape and murder are bad. If I open my mouth, it's likely I'll just add to the problem by creating more noise. I also, in thinking through this, and really as you know, I chose this topic, I was reading about it, and I had this sense that you know my sense and ideas about Buddhism and my knowledge of matters as consequential as mass violence are far apart in terms of like really trying to apply you know what I know to these kinds of questions. But beyond the obvious horror, I didn't feel any more prepared to talk about it than I am to talk about how to create a civil society or how to play the violin. It's just not something I read about it, I fret about it, but I haven't thought about, you know, what can be done. But this is a topic I chose, so I decided to try to say something. So here goes. First and most obvious, being Buddhist is not an insurance policy against ignorance, foolishness, mistakes, or doing grievous harm. Is a Buddhist someone who has never done wrong? Who will never again do wrong once they become Buddhist? Fully understands and never strays from the precepts? Can skillfully manage any kind of adversity? Whose mind is never clouded or confused? One of the things that became clear as I was reading about Buddhist nationalism and the violence associated with it is that the history behind it is exceedingly complex. Certainly, if a nation's identity is founded to some degree upon a 1,500-year-old story, then that story is going to play a part in shaping the consciousness of its people. And what's happening today is connected to what's been happening for all of time, just like everything else. One of the interesting things I read, even though I just said, you know, everything impinges on everything that happens. You know, this is a Buddhist concept and teaching. But it turns out that British colonialism is said to have helped lay the groundwork for Buddhist nationalism today. For example, in Myanmar, the British created and reinforced religious stereotypes as a way to sort of manage the populace. And those stereotypes are believed to continue to function today to bolster pejorative religious stereotypes among groups. So that's number one. Being Buddhist does not guarantee us anything about how we might be inclined to behave. Many things impinge on our behavior. Second, if I'm shocked that Buddhists would do harm to non-Buddhists, then I think the fault rests with me for not seeing clearly how things actually are and instead clinging to an idealistic views for living inside my own Buddhist bubble about what it means to be Buddhist. Third, making judgmental distinctions between myself and others is a mistake. And why? Because such distinctions, like the distinction between Buddhists and non-Buddhists, are arbitrary. In Buddhism, emptiness is said to be one of the three marks of existence. So what is emptiness? One of the definition that I've heard that is easiest for me to have a sense of is comes from Zen Master Jibong, I believe, which is no separation. No separation. So before thinking, my essential nature and someone else's essential nature are not separate. This is the teaching of Buddhism. Also, the same innumerable causes, that is to say, the same karmic forces that produce someone else, however they may be, also have produced me. This is the teaching of dependent origination. So I'm closer to others than I might think. We're all part of the same karmic web. Another thought that I had about this, and that is that if well-intentioned and faith-oriented people can, because of whatever distorted views they might hold about their faith, commit crimes against others, then I, under the right circumstances, am vulnerable to doing the same thing. Here's another point. Appreciating the effects of karma and not making harsh judgmental distinctions between myself and others doesn't mean that that I stand passively by when help is needed or when harm is being done. As I was preparing for this talk, I thought a lot about, you know, action on the one hand and, you know, formal practice on the other, sitting meditation. And I had these ideas about, you know, how convenient it is that I've chosen this path where one of the practices is this sit on your rear end for long periods of time and try to do nothing. You know, how does that stand up against, you know, when a lot of things are happening in the world that are hurting people and hurting beings. But I decided ultimately that this too is a false dichotomy between, you know, formal practice on the one hand and taking action on the other, this idea of, you know, engaged Buddhism. You know, both meditation and action are a basic foundation of our tradition. That's especially true in our own lineage that comes from Zen Master Sung San and here at Blue Heron Zen Community. And, you know, as part of our community, we do engage in action projects. There are people who lead those, including Bob, who's here, and Meg. So, those are four of the points I wanted to make. Now, here are a few other things. These are just a few final words. Even for, this is another thing that I thought about. Even for big questions and massive problems, our basic teachings and common sense, even in their most elementary forms, continue to offer us clear guidance. Here are some things of which I try to remind myself and aspire to. So, one is remain humble. So, my insight and capabilities are limited. And another, which I've already talked about, withhold harsh opinions of others. So we all spring from the same source. And there are I have plenty of work to do on myself. Continue formal practice, including meditation. Practice with the intention to see the truth clearly. Take action. Action is an aspect of my practice. Cultivate skillful means. Here, I believe, is where thinking comes into play. We don't necessarily emphasize thinking in our tradition, but right intentions alone are not sufficient for helping myself or others. Wisdom is also required. Next, make well-intentioned connections with others. Another thing I thought of, you know, there's that old phrase or saying, all politics is local. And, you know, we could also say that all Buddhist practice is local, you know, right here, right now, with, you know, myself, my body, my speech, my action. In the same way that I should try not to judge others harshly, I should also afford myself the same treatment. So so accepting myself and my mistakes so that I don't do harm to myself by condemning myself. And in doing so, then I can, if I can provide that to myself, then I can, I think, it's my opinion, can more easily provide that to others. And finally, one last thing. Ask questions and consider them deeply. Don't assume that answers to difficult problems are readily apparent. On the one, that would be a kind of arrogance. You know, we've all got an opinion, and it's all easy for us in the moment to come up with something to say. But for complex problems, how to address them is not readily apparent. And at the same time, don't assume that big problems are not insoluble over time. So that's all I have to say for right now. Thank you for being here again. Thank you for listening. May you soon attain enlightenment and save all beings.
Thank you, Paul. I really appreciate your bringing up the topic. And I think we have a responsibility to look at our community, our Buddhist community, so-called or otherwise, and talk about these issues frankly and ask those important questions, as you said. You brought up some beautiful points. I'd just like to open it up for commentary, questions, anything that anyone would like to bring forward.
One thing that came to mind was Hinayana and Mahayana traditions. And these three countries are all in the Hinayana tradition, I believe, aren't they?
I did read Theravada was sort of the dominant strain. Yeah.
But that's kind of falls short, just saying, well, it's Hinayana. Because look at Zen itself, you know, what our practice, you know, and how the samurai, you know, perverted it to their purposes of, you know, being mercenaries. So it can't be answered easily by saying it's them, you know, as a Buddhist subgroup. Our Buddhist subgroup is immune from it. We're not.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking that strain of whatever you want to call it, ignorance, whatever, is in every religious tradition. So you could easily have had your talk of what is a Christian, what is a Muslim. And I think whenever we get to the point where it's us and them, and you brought that up so well, that's where the problem is. You know, be that in a monotheistic religion where it's we've got the right God, you don't. But whenever that division comes within any religious, with anywhere, but particularly in any religious tradition, that's where you're going to get the violence coming in. That's where you're going to get the pushback. And I think it's an incredible challenge. I don't know the answer for it at all. But as you were talking, I was seeing it as there's some commonality within the human striving somehow. And it's incredibly difficult.
You know, one thing that came to mind in listening to your talk, the power of social media, along with this concurrent rise of nationalistic sentiment worldwide, and it's not surprising to me that these are two phenomena that are growing simultaneously, and it's just a reminder that whatever we envision create as a cure or a help will very likely have its dark side, and quite a significant dark side. Who would have imagined that when Facebook was dreamt up so that people could be more connected, it would create the opposite? It's very true. I know in China that people in China, their version of Facebook, they do go to that as their main source of news, and they just take it as, whatever most people are saying must be true. It's just, it's a bizarre, contrary development that will have to sort itself out, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I don't remember Facebook's byline, but it used to be something like bringing people together, connecting the world. But it does seem to have, you know, the ease of communication or finding the birds of your feather seems to have an amplification effect. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, now we have all these people.
Mm-hmm. I think what you said about being humble really resonated with me. easy to say, oh, those are bad Buddhists. Not making those distinctions. It's a, let me see, connectedness and two sides of a coin. You didn't say that, but I'm instructing that. But I appreciate your mention of humility around this.
So what about Paul's question for his talk? What is a Buddhist? Anyone want to step in and give a good answer? What is a Buddhist anyway? He didn't really tell us. Wonderful. Only that?
Can I help you?
Wonderful Buddhist. Wonderful Buddhist. Yeah. Yeah. So with that exchange, really, I wasn't setting him up, but he stepped into it so beautifully. this is pointing to the bottom line. The bottom line. So that you don't even have to say so-called Buddhist, right? Or closet Buddhist, or badge-wearing Buddhist, or any of those things. The bottom line is exactly what he presented. Clear mind. How may I be of service? Interesting, though, this when a country, a number of people are invested in the identity. There's money involved. There's power. Then things shift in a dangerous direction.
I was thinking, as you said, name a religion that hasn't perverted the message. At least what I understand most world religions to believe. And I was trying to think of your sort of like, so what is this? And I had this thought that, the difference between relativism, the relative, and the tribalism and the way we start thinking, you could still be a Buddhist and how may I help you, but it might be very local and today's help is we're gonna go burn somebody's field down or whatever, I don't know. But I was thinking the difference between a relative world that moves, as you say, I've always believed it's about power. It's tribalism, it's people fighting for resources, frequently in the name of religion, but I really think it comes down to power and fear about what you might lose or whatever and how you're going to band together and in whatever case, whatever it comes to, violence, whatever. But that absolute world, if there was a way to be much more what's really not underlying, but the real truth about, as someone said, we're really all in this all together. But it is so much the human condition to divvy up us, them, or right, wrong, or it's black, white, it's right, wrong, yeah. And our brains seem to work. It seems like that's at least one of the things of our practice is trying to move beyond that, to see it doesn't have to be, it isn't that way, but it's recognizing that that's not the way. But I think sort of lowest common denominator survival, for some reason maybe since the time of having to try to figure out how to survive, it's sort of gotten ingrained into the DNA of how we band together and make that distinction of it's us or them. And that is, and yet, you know, almost all world religions teach that's not where we're going. And certainly, as Paul answered right, it's what can I do to help you? What can I, the real question should be, what should we all be doing to help each other survive and thrive?
I just heard an interview with this Catholic sister, and I can't remember her name, but you probably recognize her. She wrote Dead Man Walking, and she does a lot of work, activism against the death penalty, and she's written a new book, and when she was talking, it sounded like it could have been a Dharma talk from John G. It was, you know, so that root that you're talking about, and the root of is the same for all of us, really. So it was just interesting to hear her story.
With the internet now, it's just amplifying something that's been there all along that's very powerful. And that's the power of the pen, power of speech, and using it in an insightful, divisive way.
Divisive.
And
power of images, too.
Yeah, and images, and the internet just explodes. You know, look at World War II and the nationalism there. It's just a bunch of rhetoric, speeches, rousing speeches. And is it in our temple rules where if you see two men fighting, use soothing words? So much fighting, though. I can't soothe. I vow to save them all.
Well, I really agree with what you said. When you were talking about the humility and thinking that point about not thinking of yourself as immune to the same thing. Sin, and which I think I just see a lot of similarities between Christianity and Buddhism, and it's possible a lot of other religions. I just investigated them, but I think that's really key. Is that this could happen to me, then that leads to also compassion for and helping. It can, you know, the other people that are involved in violence.
Yeah, I mentioned those things that I aspire to, humility being one of them. But one of the things I thought about, one of the ways I thought about approaching the talk was to talk about myself and my own shifting sort of attitude toward myself and others, and the circumstances under which, you know, I am easily provoked to thinking bad things about other people. It doesn't seem to take very much sometimes. And so really, for me, it's, you know, I mean, it's fine to talk, say these things and write them down, and helpful, you know, because, you know, just to think about them for a while reinforces them in my mind. But at the same time, I know, you know, you know, if the bus is crowded and it's hot and somebody sits down and starts talking on their cell phone really loud, I'm going to be really upset with them. And they're not going to feel very compassionate, things like that, and whatever else it may be. So
I was struck from the I was struck from the very beginning when you talked about Buddhist nationalists, and Christy started talking about the, you know, the religious traditions that fall into trouble. But we also identify with, many people identify with the country that this nationalism is we can say the same thing. So this isn't particular to religious traditions. It's not particular to some countries. It can be particular to gray-robed Buddhists versus saffron-robed Buddhists, or I'm interested in photography, and people fight on the internet all day long about what brand of camera they should wear. So one of the things that this kind of got me thinking about is going back to Zen Master Sung San's, you knew him well, but he always asked this question, who are you? And his aim was to see how we attach all sorts of things, gender, family situation, job, student, country, language we speak, blonde hair, dark hair, skin color. We all become attached to all of these things that really differentiate, look superficially differentiate ourselves with each other. So this big part of his job, I think, was just raising that question. Right? Are you biting your tongue?
No.
But I think however we identify ourselves, we're taking one step on a slippery slope. We have to be careful. And you beautifully pointed that out. So we practice this certain things, but that glue that connects us is much stronger. And it's easy to forget that. So thank you for that.
One thing I worry about is we usually talk about and try to do exercises to experience kind of together action in a positive way, but it can really go wrong. I wondered how much of sort of how our culture has emphasized individualism is just to sort of like maybe stop the fighting, and then we find ourselves feeling kind of alone and powerless and band together again, and then it can go wrong again. What can we do about that?
You might have a misunderstanding about together action. as Sung San was fond of saying about together action, it's like putting a bunch of dirty potatoes into a bucket and stirring it up, and they bump against each other and, you know, tear into each other, but that's a way of getting clean. So, I mean, you know, together action isn't, and the point is, together action isn't necessarily pretty by any means, but necessary. It's supposed to have a certain outcome.
Not even the potatoes getting clean?
Good point, yeah. Yeah. No. That's our direction. You're right.
Thank you. That makes sense as far as sometimes Zen practitioners seem to sort of take on an extreme individualistic approach to practice.
That's a delusion, because it's not individualistic. Even if you might consider that you are sitting alone on a mountaintop, it's still not individualistic. And that's one of the biggest hurdles to overcome in one's practice, is to experience that it is not individualistic at all. Kind of riding on that.
One thing that talk brought up for me is how, you know, now I identify, self-identify as Buddhism, and that's different than acting as a Buddhist, maybe, or it is. found my path in practice here at Blue Heron's End. You know, I didn't, certainly when I started, I didn't identify as a Buddhist, and over time, I think even after I took precepts the first time, you know, I put on Facebook and said atheist, you know, and then after a certain amount of time, I'm like, tired of being against stuff, you know, so I dropped the atheist, and atheist, okay, Zen Buddhist, and, you know, there's a, you know, in my life, I've tended to be skeptical of institutions, you know, and I think because I feel like they can be overwrought and overwhelming. And so it's, you know, it's not easy to identify as Zen Buddhist, and I'm not sure how much that even matters, but that identification, you know, so I'm going to do word salad, sorry, it's a lot of different thoughts here. What's that mean to identify as Buddhist? I'd be curious to hear how, what people's journeys here have been, if they do, how that's changed. And then, you know, I'm considering, you know, what's it mean to, you know, be a Buddhist in a Blue Heron Zen community compared to being a Buddhist in Myanmar? And thinking about how, you know, the nationalism aspect, you know, you'll hear, oh, America's a Christian nation. Used to be great spirit in the sky, and then evidently they identify as Buddhist nations. Anyways, just a word salad. The one aspect, I guess, I'd be interested in people's paths and identification in that way. If that's interesting.
I don't know when I started calling myself a Buddhist, but I did at some point start to say that. And I really do think of it as for what purpose do I say that? I might reserve it, you know, for certain circumstances and not others. If it functions well in that moment, then I might say that. But I do identify that way, but I don't try to put my finger on what Buddhism is, other than being, you know, aware and awake, being sort of alive and sentient, and, you know, that kind of direction, to be awake and to try to function from a position of being awake and, you know, and from a perspective of what is true. True being, you know, very straightforward, like, you know, the cushion is blue, or something like that. But yeah, I do say that sometimes. But still, you know, I still think of it as it's not something rock solid. You know, I thought about listing, you know, what it might mean to be a Buddhist. Is it somebody who, you know, accepts the precepts? Well, then are you not a Buddhist if you don't follow them one day? Or if you just say that you are, but then, you know, what happens when you go to sleep at night and you're not saying anything or thinking anything, you know, then are you still a Buddhist? You know, all kinds of ways to look at it that never really, that really aren't solid, ultimately.
Yeah, I think this practice has been, I've experienced, not just a change in identification as a Buddhist, but, you know, what am I, right? It's our,
Something else I wanted to throw out, and I meant to work this in, but I didn't, and that is that I'm pretty sure, and I have read, there are lots of people in Myanmar, Sri Lanka, and Thailand who are Buddhists who don't, you know, want to exterminate people of other religions. You know, these are dominant kinds of social forces that I'm talking about that don't apply to individuals.
Maybe there's that saying about taking medicine, you know, you give the medicine to the sick person, but when the sick person is no longer sick, they don't need the medicine anymore. So, you don't have the medicine, are you a Buddhist? There's always another sickness.
Yeah. If you say, I don't need any more medicine, I think you're for this.
That's from our letter in Swamps and Flowers.
Yeah, right? That was, we were talking about.
I was thinking about, you know, that when they survey people in America, even people who say they're Christian, they know very little about their own tradition and thinking, well, you know, maybe a lot of people that are doing this just aren't very knowledgeable about what Buddhism is and its an ethnic identity. But then you said about sort of these, some of the monks and kind of instigating some of this. And so I thought, okay, that doesn't really explain it. But then Myanmar's been kind of a very repressive military regime for years, and being a monk is kind of a position of authority, and I wonder how that gets delegated in the country with that kind of system. It's, yeah, what do you do from here about that? But like, okay, we can do something.
I'm hopeful, you know, in regards to what you just brought up. I'm hopeful. I think that when there's a relatively new spiritual direction in a culture, and Buddhism being pretty new in the Western world, there's a there aren't those entrenched powers habits of structures that are so deeply embedded in one way or another. So there's a wonderful freshness that we're a part of just by being alive and practicing right now. I mean, granted, there are many missteps and confusions, but we also have this unusual benefit, I think, of having to be pretty new. So that naturally there's some, you know, none of us are monks or nuns, and none of us we're not supported financially by this enterprise, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing. I mean, we're supporting each other in various ways, but it's not just the logistics of power are not at them. There's not that problem, and I think there's the natural because this is a culture that had some ideas of democracy. Here we are sitting in a circle right now and having a conversation, which is already radically different than it would be in these predominantly Buddhist countries, I'm pretty sure.
One of the things for me is the whole attachment piece, be it to institution or name or nationality. And I was really impressed when I heard that Ram Dass with his Seva Foundation, every year when the board meets, the very first question is, do we dissolve Seva? Every year. And only when there's consensus that yes, indeed, we move forward, do they take that. But everyone goes into that meeting knowing that the first question is, do we dissolve this organization? And that just to me was different, to say the least, but just a sense of non-attachment to the entity per se. You know, be that a nation, not that you're going to go into a parliamentary thing and say, we dissolve this nation, but, you know, just that sense of openness to the possibility of non-attachment.
That reminds me of Buddha's statement that he used the metaphor of all of my teaching is like a raft to help you cross over to the other shore. And once you reach the other shore, there's no need for the raft. So that's, I see a lot of this, whether it's nationalism or factionalism, religious, there's a lot of people feeling there's something that's to protect. And this growing idea that if we don't do something radical, this threat that oftentimes, sometimes is real, but is amplified. Spawns some of this, I think, and it's amplified by the internet, et cetera, et cetera. But I love that idea of, or we're here to try to accomplish something, not to create an everlasting institution.
Yeah, you know, I kind of thought a little bit sad, kind of sadness when you said, well, this is, we're part of a new, in the West, the new Zen tradition, and that's a benefit. Well, does that mean that, you know, it's going to become older and entrenched in these kinds of things and have these kinds of problems from that happen? I mean, something's been around for a while, but then I've actually, you know, even if it disappears or if our tradition disappears, it had a purpose or it had a function in its time. And that's kind of, I guess, the idea of impermanence.
A difficult question to bring up. You know, when we became aware of horrendous acts done by Buddhists elsewhere in the world, you know, through that article. I mean, it's been in the news for a while now. What is our responsibility? I mean, yes, first of all, there's our practice and being of service, and you mentioned all political, all politics is local, something, all practice is local. What is local? What are the perimeters of local? And isn't that in danger of becoming somewhat tribal in itself? So what is our responsibility as Buddhists? When other Buddhists elsewhere behave very badly. There was I belong to this organization, American Zen Teachers Association, and there was a letter being circulated that was for those who are interested to sign a petition vocalize a disapproval of these acts as Buddhist leaders. I did not sign that letter. And I do disapprove, and yet I did not sign the letter. And I'm a little unsure as to why it came out that way. I mean, I couldn't tell you. I couldn't give you my rationale behind that. But I do sense a kind of caution around jumping on any bandwagon. I appreciated your point of our information is partial, but it's still there. We still have information. We have a responsibility to that. I don't know. It's something I'm struggling with, and I don't. I am I an authority that is that can speak out?
Yeah. To the outside world, you are.
Yeah.
To whom was that letter to be sent?
I think it was sent to the government, some government.
The government
of in Myanmar. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Some of the more outspoken monks are, you know, identified in these articles. And one of the thoughts for the talk was that I would figure out an address, like a temple address or something, and then come with pieces of paper and have everybody write a letter, write their own letter, and discuss what to write.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still thinking about writing a letter, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and then how do you do that? By what skillful means do you create something, a message?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was also going to say, I feel like I don't have enough information just now, but I remember, you know, one of the things, say, what is a Buddhist? And we were all just saying, it's right now, and it's, how can I help you? And you would think that there would be a basis, but what I was thinking back to was when 9/11 occurred, you know, a lot of us were also trying to say, it is a small sliver of Muslims who are radicalized. And feeling, and yet they were all being painted with a broad brush. And so one of the things was to say, that's not the majority of the religion. And the same thing of, you can name all sorts of instances of current right-wing Christians who do things that I don't think are so cool, but does that represent all of Christianity, or there's different? So can hear where I'd like to think that perhaps it's the people who are in power, whoever just said whatever the monks are who've been appointed, or, you know, who are also supporting some of the you know, violent acts and some other. I'd like to think that's not the majority of Buddhists, but I don't know. But it does seem like sometimes speaking, pointing out the truth, or again, that things are not just black, it's to think that all Myanmars are bad people is probably not right. You said there's a lot of people who are Buddhists there who don't support the kind of things that are going on. So I don't know what the right action letter writing or whatever it would be. But I think the place to start also is not jumping to the conclusion of a whole nation is evil. A lot of times it's only those people who are in power who are carrying out evil acts.
Well, we're not there, though. We're here.
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah. So, you know, all politics is local, and our interaction with people is local, and so don't we have more of a duty just to our practice here and helping people here? You know, there's a lot of shit going on wrong with our country and in our city. We don't have to go all the way to Miramar.
What I've been, this is timely, because in the last week I've had some interactions in Seattle with Buddhists of other traditions who are appalled at the invasion by the immigrants, and who are just taking the Fox News line.
Mm-hmm.
And I am completely flummoxed as to what to do, because it's local.
Mm-hmm.
It's right here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I've gone through from just wanting to never speak to them again, you know, the total disgust thing, and realizing that's pretty arrogant on my part, not helpful at all,
mm-hmm.
and trying to trying to understand, but I don't know what to do. I really don't have any idea what to do.
That's a good place to start. Let me just offer that, just from my perspective, as frustrating and maddening as that is. That is starting from a don't know mind. So, with that, giving that the space to be, to not know, and then you'll see. You'll find out. I guess one of the things that I've always appreciated about Buddhism is that we don't offer a prescription, per se. Local, again, I'm just going to toss around, just, I know it's getting late, but that term local, there are a lot of ways. You could say it's our local cosmos. We have each of us different kind of orientation. Some of us are more involved politically than others. Some of us are more globally interactive. And some of us are neighbor by neighbor, more interactive. And that is, for us to discover. And honor.
We can also say that local is commonly thought to be about 2 inches behind here, and maybe we can do some cleanup work to root out any kind of tendency we have to create us, them, good,
bad. Following that, I will give you very, very local, which was my local small grocery store. And I went in the other day, they have prepared meals that you can do, and I needed a prepared meal, and I went in. And they were all, everything that was left was East Indian food. And what I wanted wasn't there. And there are many East Indians that have come into my neighborhood. And I watched it arise, and it was just, oh, it's all about them now. And I thought, this is where it starts. This is where it starts. And to be able to see that and recognize that and go and get something that was good and sweet and nice. But to realize that it was that arising at my local grocery store that was the energy of where it could start with me.
Something that occurred to me while I was thinking some of these things through was, again, this false dichotomy between trying to wake up and see clearly and taking action on the other. And when we take action, we don't have all the information. We never have all the information. So sometimes you have to do something. And you do it with some percentage of ignorance and then make mistakes. Make adjustments as you go along. So whether you do it right the first time or do it right ever, you're still, if your intention is correct, if your intention is to be helpful, then in a certain way you don't make mistakes by trying to do your best, whatever you end up doing. Some people might think you did. Or say you did.
It's all one big mistake.
So all
we've got that
mistake.
Covered. Well, I just want to comment on I'm feeling there's an effect of rather than having two people sitting separate and a lineup, it has a different feeling. Having a circle. for this. Wouldn't you say? It's pretty cool. Appreciating the experiments. So thank you. Thanks everyone for participating, for being here, for listening, for exploring. You know, we can continue the super local, as Pope Sunny was saying, for the retreat, and tap into the big local at the same time. Help all be.